Okay, Peter. Well, I'd love to hear about how you got your start in photography and what about your early life, led you to it, and what kind of just broadly some of the questions that I have are. The techniques that you've used over your career and some of your favorite opportunities so far. I figured we'd start with that. So why don't you tell me, how you ended up in the career that you have now?
Okay, that's lovely. Please ask me any questions as I go along.
Okay.
I'm a born and bred London photographer. I was educated in the 1950s and the 1960s at a school called Holland Park in London, in Kensington. It was a huge school with 2,500 kids. It's now known as Socialist Eton because of politicians' children that went to the school later on. It had amazing facilities, including a large swimming pool, three gymnasiums, woodwork, metalwork, engineering, technical drawing office, domestic science, language laboratory. And finally, it had brilliant dark rooms and studios. I was taught on plate cameras with glass plate negatives.
Can you tell me a bit about what's involved in that? Because I've never heard of.
Well, it's before we got to film,
Okay.
and it takes it goes back in time, so it's a long time ago. I mean, it's quite remarkable how not even in a lifetime, in a speck of a lifetime, we've gone from glass plates through to digital photography, and now everybody's a photographer. Everybody with a decent phone is able to take wonderful pictures. Anyway, I think that photography found me at school. I was struggling hopelessly with dyslexia. Neither I nor the tutors knew anything about it. My form teacher used to keep a cane called Brother Sunshine above the blackboard, which he used to beat us with. I suppose now it's funny to think about, maybe he enjoyed doing that, but I had a really tough time at school. And then in the Easter holidays, age 15, I saw an ad for an assistant photographer in an advertising studio. And I went along for an interview with my mum, and they gave me a job. So, age 15, I left school and never went back there again. Even in my first job in 1963, we did prints of logos from glass plates. And it was a wonderful environment. It was full of the most amazing creatives. Illustrators, airbrush artists, paint up artists, typographers, hand lettering artists that you could see the talent dripping off their fingers. And now sadly, nearly all of those skills have now disappeared, and Macs have taken over a lot of the creativity. So that's how I arrived at being a photographer.
I think a lot of artist types can relate to struggling with the structure of school. And it sounds like your school was very difficult in some aspects as far as like teachers being like aggressive as far as punishment and things along those lines. But from what you say, the school had good funding and encouraged creativity with a variety of mediums. So that it's
Well, I think there are lots of things behind it. I have two children who suffer from dyslexia and a bit of ADHD. It's also, I believe, hereditary. And I've kind of turned my dyslexia into what I call a superpower of problem solving and thinking and dealing with things. Recently, I gave a talk at my son's school about my superpower, and I asked how many of the kids in the audience were dyslexic, and all the hands went up. It was quite quite amazing. Mm-hmm. And my idea of problem solving is to get other people to help and do things. So so I put into ChatGPT three words saying speech, school, and dyslexia. And instantly I was, I had two pages of copy. So rather than me read it out, I get the kids to read it out. And then I ask AI, what are the dangers of AI? And worrying, the answer it gave me were, let me read this to you. There is a risk of superintelligence. If we are not careful, AI will become smarter than humans, leading to a situation where we lose control of technology. This could lead to an existential threat to humanity, as we could no longer influence our own destiny. I think it has AI is going to become so important in our lives. I think it already is, probably we don't realize. It does wonderful things, like it's 20% at finding cancer on scans than doctors can do. They're now having people with artificial legs and arms using AI to work with their brain to help them function. Amazing things. There are scientists in Japan that are showing people pictures of trains and clocks and things, and then they're scanning their brain and actually producing pictures of what they're seeing. They may not be brilliant, but you can see what they are. And the thing about AI is it doesn't forget, it just gets better and it just keeps learning. And I mean, one of the things that, as a Brit, one of the things that fascinates me about America is with all the great, wonderful people in America, how on earth have you ended up with your two president? I'll say. And I read in the paper yesterday, like, I wrote this quote down, it says, get ready for the first AI election. As recent fake images of Donald Trump and Mike Pence show, there are fears computer-generated scans will sway the polls. What do you think about that? How frightening is that? Yeah. I mean, it goes on. I mean, we've got cameras that are... AI cameras that are scanning drivers, and they're able to catch people that aren't wearing a seatbelt or are using their phone. So Big Brother is continuing to catch up on us.
Yeah, as on this subject, I feel in general the major issue is we haven't evolved in our humanity to use AI responsibly. So I think that's the core issue, is it's developing faster than our capacity to understand ourselves. So, but then
right. It's when the governments, you know, say they're going to control it. I mean, I think they can just dream on. That isn't going to happen. I mean, lots of, from the creative side, I know in music and photography, you know, AI just scrapes stuff off the internet. You know, your great picture can be my great picture tomorrow. What are you going to do about it? You know, you can put your picture into AI and say, can you turn it into a Picasso? And it'll do all that for you. So it's like, it's a very unusual time. Copyright is going to be difficult to... You know, the copyright cat is out of the bag. I don't really know how we're going to get it back in or deal with it. But anyway, I'm trying to have a happy day. I'm not trying to depress the world. So it's just something that we need to be aware of. And, you know, when you have, there are AI news readers, you know, how do we know what to believe? And you can see what happens in some of the countries of the world where they completely manipulate the media. There was a lovely thing I saw out of North Korea. I'm a golfer as well, so don't hold that against me. But the previous president of North Korea, on his first round of golf, had 11 holes in one, which is, you know, people are lucky to get a hole in one in their life, not in their first round of golf. And it's kind of interesting how they manipulate things to, you know, make somebody to be better or greater than, you know, than reality can show. I'm just a humble photographer, just making my way in life, I guess.
These are fascinating questions. I don't find it depressing at all. I think it's important to talk about. I didn't hear about that, but I think it's just a ridiculous signal of virtue. I can't believe that they actually manipulated whatever they were using in order to make him seem that way, and for it to be golf and not even like a serious
no golf is serious.
Well, forgive me. I mean, I guess I was comparing it to, like, you know, his work as a so-called leader or dictator, you know. But yes, whatever I'm engaged in that I'm very passionate about, I do take it very seriously. But I haven't really gotten into golf. I think it seems very involved. But yeah, as far as AI and art, it seems like for certain skills you can definitely get very far with it, and then such as copywriting. But I think there's at least for now, there's sort of a ceiling to it, where a brilliant wordsmith might take a little longer to make something, but it'll still be better. Maybe not grammatically, although maybe, because maybe they're more hip to, you know, how we communicate during this time than AI is. I'm not really sure, but it might still have a tone in the writing that the AI might not be able to convey. The same with AI art. I've seen beautiful AI art that does give me a feeling of beauty and skill, but I still resonate so much more with art that's being made by humans. And I'm not sure if I'm biased because I already know who is making it, but it still feels like there's a human element that the current level of AI doesn't really have. Same with music. I feel like really great artists can create with the assistance of AI, and that could lead to even more art. You know, it'll allow artists to be even more prolific. But I think AI, at least where we are right now, making music on its own, I think there's a ceiling to what it's able to do.
No, I absolutely agree. But I mean, I think, you know, it is a tool for lots of different artistic things. But I do think, don't underestimate how well I think it will become. Mm-hmm. Because it just learns. That's all it's interested in doing. And You know, I mean, we've been dealing with AI, but not really thinking about it in all sorts of different ways that we go about our life with call centers and all sorts of things. I mean, they're now starting to get rid of people in call centers and replacing it with AI because the AI is better at doing it. And probably it's not a lot of fun working in a call center. So it's just business and going forward. And I don't think, you know, the world will be able to stop it, but hopefully that good things, you know, if we can save people's lives because of medical research, you know, there are lots of good things that we can look forward to. And I think it will be an assistance. I mean, if you think about music, there have always been different techniques that you could bring in and add to your music and be, you know, digitally controlling it and slowing it down or improving it. There are, you know, we've been doing it for a long time. So we'll just have to lay back and see what happens, I guess. The thing that I've been working on, which is the new book that's coming out in October, is the complete opposite of AI. It's about taking photography back to its origins. So maybe I should talk about that and explain a little bit about it.
Sure, I would love you to discuss that.
Okay, and please stop me when I do technical stuff. Maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense. My new book is called Monochrome, and it was the lovely Sam Landers of Trope Publishing in Chicago who picked up on my work, came over to London for dinner, and we agreed the concept. And I delivered pictures within a month or so. It was most of the imagery had been produced over the last decade, so it was kind of there ready to go. And in a tiny speck of time, the design was done and it was put together and sent off to China to be printed. My fine artwork is a kind of journey of discovery, experimenting with different processes, lenses, techniques, such as X-ray, mammogram, limited focus, anamorphic lenses, and solarization. I'm always looking for photographing people, things, and places I find visually stimulating. A lot of my work starts as a clean piece of paper, putting the ingredients together, be it an object or a collaborative model, stylist, hair and makeup artist, and seeing what magic occurs. And for this book, a lot of it is visits to the Covent Garden Flower Market early in the morning to see what beautiful flowers have come in. And I don't just want to take pictures, I want to create them, which has led me to work with the father and son team of Paul and Max Gaffel of 31 Studios in England, the foremost specialist in platinum printing. It's devised from a technique developed by William Wallace in 1876. And it involves French handmade watercolor paper, which is then coated, laid in emulsion using a goat's hair brush. And this is probably part of the genius behind it, because it's such a skill to apply a technique to a piece of paper without any runs or drips. The prints are then made from a full-size internegative and contact printed. In the past, they would have been exposed by sunlight, but now they're exposed by ultraviolet light. So the printer sits there with goggles on, dodging the light to improve the image as he exposes the negative. The print is then developed in a solution of potassium oxalate. Development becomes up instantly, unlike a bromide print that we would have been using in the past. It's placed in a water warm wall and agitated to remove as much of the developer as possible. It produces wonderful tones, much more than we see with digital and bromide prints. It's also archival, so it will last many lifetimes, which may be not the same for some of the digital prints that that have been left out and exposed to daylight and start to fade. But it's wonderful, and for me, working is a kind of a party when you encourage people to come and help you with their ideas or their input. And the guys at 31 Studios, so I was interesting in doing solarization, which again goes back in time. And there was a period where Man Ray, who was working with Lee Miller, who was a photographer who was his muse for many years, a great photographer in her own right, was in the dark room. And a mouse ran over her foot, and she turned the light on and turned it off quickly. And by exposing the paper, the paper to light, it kind of reverses the image. So you get this wonderful kind of solarization effect. And so that was kind of rediscovered by Man Ray, and a lot of his work ended up with solarization. But in modern times, it's also great to have the use of a computer as well as doing platinum printing. So it's kind of done on computer and when it's being processed to be flashed with light, and it gives this wonderful result. Well, that was a lot of the information. Any questions about that?
Yeah, as you're talking about it, I'm looking at your portfolio, and I'm just curious first how the effect of sunlight or just light differs from ultraviolet light, and what the...
No, I mean, ultraviolet light is just doing the same thing. There's not color involved. It's all in black and white. So it's just, you know, they didn't have ultraviolet light in the past. That was what you just put your picture out to be exposed to the sun. So it's you know, it's a different world, but it's the whole process behind it, of the chemicals that go into it, quite threatening chemicals that are used and put together and mixed. And it's a kind of, you've got the precious noble metal platinum, and it's like a chemical alchemy.
Yeah,
what more can I tell you?
It's brilliant. I have no idea how you could get some of the definition that you achieve in these, and whether it's the shadows, with what we typically use today. I mean, I have a DSLR camera here, and I just think this is a completely different animal. And I think that...
Yeah, but you're ahead of the game. You know, digital cameras are wonderful things. You know, you've got great control of lighting, mixed lighting, long exposures. You've got fantastic latitude of the image that you're creating. Whereas if you were working on film, or especially transparency, if you overexposed it or underexposed it, you end up with something that doesn't work, which is unusable. So digital cameras have really, in my mind, I suppose, I kind of think I'm cheating when I'm shooting with a digital camera. But that's a long way from where we are today. I was in Florida at Christmas. I was on Naples Beach in Naples, and I was taking pictures at sunset. So it's very backlit. It's quite difficult to deal with it. And so I was taking pictures on an expensive Nikon camera, and my kids were using an iPhone. And when we looked at the results, the iPhone was producing way better pictures. Mm. And so, like, you know, difficult, the difference in cameras is that, you know, with a with an ordinary camera, you can't, you know, you've got to wait for the thing to be processed, or you've got to, you know, it's not like a phone where you can instantly send the picture somewhere. You know, you can enhance them and do them on your phone. The phones are a wonderful thing. Apparently, according to the internet, there are in excess of 800 engineers working on the iPhone camera alone. So if you're the managing director of Canon or Olympus or Nikon, you're probably having sleepless nights. So, I mean, we go back in time. The funny things about life is that Kodak, that was one of the great blue chip companies of the world, invented the digital camera. And then, because they didn't want to lose the sales of cameras, film processing, and prints, they hid the camera away and ultimately went bust. You know, if they'd had any insight, any genius, they could have been Apple. You know, it's sad to see companies that kind of lose the plot like that, I think.
What did you mean by they? So how? What decisions did they make that prevented them from evolving?
Because their income. Because I guess, you know, as we talk about AI now, we don't really know where we're going with it. Digital cameras were not a thing. They discovered a digital camera. They produced the first digital camera. And their decision was, we make all our money from selling analog cameras and selling film and then processing the film and then doing the prints. That was where their money came from. The biggest department in, do you want to have a guess at the biggest department in Kodak?
Perhaps.
Let me put you out of your misery.
Yes.
apparently it was litigation, because they had so many different patents that they were spending their time protecting their patents. But it was a huge company, you know, with huge factories, and you know that it's so sad when all those people kind of just, you know, they just lost their job and it goes bust. No doubt the directors all went off and had a nice life in retirement, but it was an opportunity that was missed. Does that make sense, or is it still a bit confusing?
So, I guess I remember those cameras, but I must be a little bit my reference for how a camera works is still, you know, based on the equipment I have now. So it's a little fuzzy as to how it used to work, but they were still digital cameras, but they operated with film. Is that correct?
No.
Right.
They were digital camera is digital. You don't need film with a digital camera. You need a memory stick, and then you take your memory stick out and you stick it into a computer, and then you can manipulate them, blow them up, or print them. You know, as when, I don't know whether that's the same for you, but when I was young, most families had an album for which they kept their family's pictures in. Because you'd get your film and you'd take it to the drugstore and get it. You'd wait several days to get it back and have the prints. And then when we had prints, we used to put them in an album and save them. It was all growing up. But now people are keeping their prints digitally on computers. And, you know, I think, because of what I do for a living, I had my stuff backed up all over the place, because I'm paranoid that, you know, I might lose the computer or something, and you'd lose all your work. So that's another important thing to think about. but also, you know, it was the delay with a digital camera. You can see the result instantly, or on a phone, you can see the result. And the thing about a phone is you can send the picture to your friends. You can put it on social media without having to go anywhere else. It's there on your phone. A lot of people, this is something that may upset some of the creatives. A lot of people believe greatly in shooting on film, that it's a wonderful medium. And I think, to me, it was never that good. We never viewed it in the same way that we view a digital file. It was never that sharp. And if you have a great picture that you think you'd really like on film, the first thing that you do is scan it. So then it becomes a second generation. So it's just better to start off with a digital file with amazing opportunities of what you can do with it.
Do you think how accessible it is to produce something and to even publish it makes the process less meaningful?
No, I think the opposite. I think phones are making it incredibly easy to take pictures. Earlier this year, I bought a new iPhone 14 Pro, which shoots amazing large files. And I think a lot more professionals will be using iPads and iPhones. That's happening a lot in fashion photography already. It just is very easy to see what you're doing. It deals so well with imagery. So in some ways, that's more difficult for professionals. But it's great that, you know, everybody can be a good photographer, a reasonable photographer, and maybe learn a little bit of that composition. But it's something that's given everybody the opportunity of taking really good pictures.
Do you foresee the iPhone having more parameters, such as, and I know they have a little bit of this, but you think it'll become a little bit more manual, where they have a lot more control over shutter speed and aperture, ISO?
I understand that, but I don't think in reality people just want to be able to take pictures easily, you know, in dark conditions, you know, or in bright sunlight. You know, you don't. It's just making the process of taking pictures simpler. And I really don't think there's much not to like about that. You know, the fact that people have the ability to create, you know, it's lovely. People can, you know, it's taking it further. It's like, when you've got a great picture, it's like, let's print it, let's sign it, let's date it, put it in a frame, put it up on the wall and admire it, be proud of what you do. But I guess a lot, you know, most of the digital stuff will just stay on computers or on their phones. But if I go back to my youth, although we were working with films, we were shooting on glass plates, you know, which is a pretty precarious thing because they, you know, you can chip or drop them very easily. And, you know, to me, it's just amazing how in my short lifetime, photography has changed. And I suppose we see that, you know, in all sorts of art now with, you know, the modern paints of acrylics and computer images and the way that it helps people create.
It doesn't seem like you are in the camp of just because something takes longer and is more meticulous that makes it of higher quality. Even though you have a deep appreciation for these other ways of shooting.
Maybe that's so. I mean, I just kind of think it's kind of nice that it's easy for people to take pictures and create themselves. And there clearly is a lot of thought and an effort goes into the stuff that I do, but it's good that we can encourage people to be creative, I think. That it shouldn't be, seen as elitist. It should be something that we can all acquire. And hopefully as a professional, I'll be able to do it just a little bit better, or in some ways a little bit more desirable. And having the book out, this is, I think, my sixth book I've done, and it's a lovely thing to see it in print. That somebody, a publisher, kind of liked what I was doing and wanted to. Publishing is quite a precarious thing. I was talking to my last publisher, and I was because usually you get an advance on a book. And I'd read somewhere about how many books make back their advance, and so I said to him, apparently only one book in 100 makes back the advance that was paid out to the creator.
Wow.
So obviously publishing is a lot more scary than I realized. So I'm very grateful to the Trope in Chicago.
It's interesting that there's less of a barrier to entry for different creative endeavors. I've seen it lead to really great outcomes in music. I mean, there's no shortage of information on how to get started, whether that's on the internet or teachers available to help you. But I do think when it is easier to get your hands on that information, it's very tempting just to work laterally. You kind of jump from one, sub area like within your craft to another without treating any of them with as much depth as you might if it were harder to get your hands on some of the knowledge and information.
I suppose I have great belief in making things happen. I think creatively, we all kind of deal with insecurities, I guess. But it's the way that you make things happen, whether it's blagging somewhere or getting your work in front of people. It's not something you can't really sit at home waiting for the phone to ring. I'm extremely because we quite often get young photographers who want to get some work experience or make their way in life, and I have helped quite a lot of youngsters and mentored them, but I'm kind of shocked by the fact that you get emails from kids saying, "Dear photographer man, dear sir or madam," or where you can see across the top of the email the other 50 photographers they've written the same letter to. You can see it all. And this, I mean, my agent also gets calls from kids that say, "We really love Peter's work. Could we come in and show him our book?" And because I do all sorts of different kind of things, my agent will say to them, "Well, which bit of Peter's work is it that you really like?" And that's the end of the phone call. They're blagging their way. They're trying to get on the first run, and they've just fallen off it. And that disappoints me. I mean, maybe it's kind of things that Your parents teach you in life how to make your way, but you want to help, you want to get help from people. But I find that really troubling, you know, that they can be that daft and sad. You know, leaving school at 15, you know, I didn't really get much education. It was, you know, who knows what happens if I'd, you know, if my dyslexia had been discovered and I'd had extra special help for it, who knows what I might have done. But, you know, I've been very fortunate in my career. And I do believe a lot of it is, you know, getting your work in front of people, experimenting, doing different things, you know, doing whatever might be next. You know, as I said earlier, my monochrome book includes, you know, different techniques, including, you know, like getting into hospitals and getting use on an X-ray machine and seeing what you can do with it, or a mammogram where you can put a flower in front of a mammogram. You know, they're just trying to do something that's different and trying to experiment. And experimenting is a great thing, because you can make lots of mistakes and lots of errors, but you can learn from it. You know, you can suddenly do something that's really, some of the work that I do is advertising work. And so you're working with lots of fine art directors and creatives. And there have been sort of occasions in my career where I've been working with an art director, and I'm shooting this thing, and I'm thinking, this is really wrong. Why are we doing it like this? And we kind of, I'm kind of thinking, maybe this isn't right. This doesn't look quite right. And so the job goes out the door, and in a couple of months, you kind of see the advertising campaign coming out, and you go, wow, that guy has taken me to somewhere that I would have never have found on my own. You know, it's like, you know, it's like being influenced by people around you, like the party that we try to have, that, you know, my digital retoucher will be, you know, I'll never be as good as she is, but, you know, I'll say, well, can we do this? And she say, well, yeah, we can do this, but we also do that. And then, you know, something will come to light, and I'll be seeing something that I didn't imagine or didn't expect. So I do think that experimenting is a great thing for me in photography, just to see where something might go.
I feel you're more able to experiment when you have more inspiration and to synthesize from. And I think what can be stifling when you're first starting is you find one area of the craft that you really like, and you're pretty much, it's very easy to commit to that as your thing. When, you know, before you realize that there are so many parts or so many different sources of inspiration within the craft that you can mix and experiment with. And I'm kind of guilty of this too, because when I started, I had my favorite genres of music, and now I just think that as much as I go through phases of what I like and what I'm making, it's silly to have too strong of a preference, because that's really not where the best art comes from. Like it really comes from the experimentation and those kind of happy accidents that occur. And as much as it feels like it can kind of feel to the creator that it's kind of unskillful when you have these accidents, but really the only reason that the beauty comes out of these accidents are from all of the inspiration that you've taken in over the course of your learning. And so I think the prerequisite to having those perfectly conspired accidents are to have inspiration from a variety of different sources. And so
I think that I do tell youngsters that have a camera with you at all times. I think there have been several occasions where I've seen somebody or something and wished I had a camera with me and lost an opportunity that I kind of, that still sits in the back of my mind thinking about that. And now it's easier because, you know, I have a phone in my back pocket. But I mean, it's some things that come as a surprise. When my 12-year-old was being born in hospital by cesarean, I mean, I kind of think if it was left to, for men to have kids, I don't know how many kids we'd have, because it's pretty tough. So I'm sitting with next to my wife's head, and there's a screen up while they're doing the cesarean, and I love kind of blagging your way and just seeing what happens. So I say to the surgeon, "No, could I just take a couple of pictures?" And he said, "Oh, hang on a minute, I'll lower the screen." And I got two frames of my son's first breath. And you know, there's blood and there's the surgeon and everybody kind of around it. It's kind of, to me, it's a lovely picture. It's a moment in time. But for me, the most fun thing about it was that in my stupidity, I decided everybody should share this, and I put it on my social media sites. And it was the emotion that it caused. People who were very upset about seeing the image, and people that really loved the image. Some people were quite brutal about it. You know, you shouldn't be putting up stuff like that. And to me, to create an image that creates emotion in people, good and bad, is just brilliant. You know, that's something that, you know, I suppose I had a camera because I had that in my mind, but I didn't know whether they would let me do that or whether it'd be feasible. But it's a beautiful picture, of which my son now is kind of irritated by if I tell people about it or show it to people. But that's something to me that's kind of really special, that you can create images that create emotion.
I love that as a qualifier for what's exceptional art. And it's very easy to forget that, at least for me sometimes, when I'm focusing on the craft element of it, or like how clever can something be, or is this skillful or not? And really, that's just a part of it. Like it's really about whether it evokes something or it doesn't. Like does it evoke something or does it not? Does it happen or does it not? And I think every artist could keep that in mind more, and it would help with their process.
Yeah, it's a mountain to climb, and the sense of achievement, I think. Yeah, you know, I think, as I said earlier, you know, dealing with the insecurities of, you know, if you're trying to get a particular job or a commission, you know, why you get it on or you don't get it, why the next guy gets it. To me, the most important thing is to feel good about yourself and what you're doing. You know, you can't influence, you know, you can influence about a foot all the way around you, but you can't influence what other people think or say about your work. And it's to me, mentally, it's just feeling good about you, what you're doing, and hope people enjoy it.
Do you feel like you've been able to keep that sentiment in sort of the forefront of your mind throughout your career? Or do you think, do you feel like you've had other, you know, qualifiers of success? In other words, were you more focused on the improvement wheel and achievement, or even when you were focused on those things, were you able to keep in mind what you just said earlier in your career, that, you know, feeling good about your work was the number one priority?
Yeah, what would I say about that? I used to think about, you know, the idea of not giving people what they want, but giving people what they want next and anticipating what people want. It's a journey. It is a journey of discovery, and you're learning as you go along. And you make mistakes and you learn from them. You know, the worst thing is making the same mistake twice. There have been several great photographers who took their own life, which is, successful photographers who took their own life. Donovan and Bob Carlos Clark. How you deal with rejection, or whether you just don't think you're good enough. And I don't know that we're ever good enough. I win awards, and I've had some amazing awards, and that's there in the background. But I don't know. Awards are a little bit arbitrary, but they do feel good. But to me, it is feeling good about what you're doing and what you're doing in life, how you're feeling in life, in your family and your relationships and things. I think, and I don't kind of want that to be heavy, but it's just, just trying to help other people and help youngsters coming up and encouraging and mentoring. I don't think it should be. I want to help young photographers because it's difficult enough. In this country, we're educating something like 20,000 photographers. And there are people doing 3-year degrees in university, and they're ending up with a shed load of debt. And it's becoming more and more difficult because people can take their own photographs. And the tutors are not going to tell the kids how difficult it will be. They put their pictures up on Instagram and TikTok, and their friends say what a great photographer you are and how good you are. So there's a lot of young kids thinking that, how difficult can this be? In reality of making your way in photography, whether it's fine art or advertising or sport or whatever, it isn't easy. I think that photography may become more like acting, that there will be resting time where you may need a second career. To me, it's sad that all those kids are spending that kind of money in 3 years of their life that they may not be able to make, turn it into a living, I guess.
Do you feel like social media is a non-negotiable for displaying your portfolio, or do you feel like there are still other pathways to develop at the beginning and establish yourself in photography?
I think my social media is more about interesting stories that I want to share, or whether it was an interesting program, or I've been seen a stage show that I thought was interesting. In recent years, I produced 4 books on London, including a book on London theatres, which is just that was a project that was an immense amount of fun to me, because we go to a theatre and we sit down facing forward in the dark, to be entertained and amused. And we never really see the kind of heritage and beauty of our theatres. And so doing a book with Sir Mark Rylands was a fantastic opportunity to go backstage, under the stage, above the stage, dressing rooms, technical rooms. So that's the sort of thing that I put on social media, things that, you know, I want to share. So if I go and see a play, then we'll find a picture from the book and put it up on social media and say, go see this. So they're kind of hobbies, I suppose, to just doing different sorts of things. So if you look at my website, you can see I do a whole kind of odd range of things, always looking for different sort of projects that might be interesting to other people, just to entertain. So I think social media is fun. I fail to quite see how women seem to be aiming at having longer eyelashes, huge eyebrows and bigger lips, and then distorting the picture digitally as well. I'm not quite sure how we've arrived at some of that. And the reality of what, you know, not what people really look like, that we want to recreate ourselves. I hope that doesn't upset anybody listening. It's just something, as an old man, I kind of find a bit strange.
I don't think so. I don't think that upsets anybody. I think there's so much emphasis for young people on using it to further your career or to get started in a creative profession, that it's very refreshing to hear somebody say that you don't have to use it in a professional capacity. You can use it for entertainment and just to document your process. It doesn't have to be an income stream or a major platform for your work. I'm speaking from experience. There's so much emphasis on using that to get on the radar of people you may respect, you know, in your field. So it's actually very nice to hear an opposing viewpoint on that.
Well, maybe I'm doing it wrong, but certainly I am fascinated about, I'm fascinated by influencers, because I personally don't get it. You know, it's just people are being paid money to tell me what I should be buying. I mean, it's just, and you make money by doing that. It's just slightly odd to me. I mean, I don't follow any influencers. It's just, I guess it's just like an ad in a magazine. You're just paying somebody to do an ad and put their name to it. But you know, if it works, and you know, I don't want to stand in the way of anybody doing anything, but I'm just a bit amazed that people can make vast amounts of money being an influencer.
Yes, it's surprising. The amount of money that you could potentially make if you're part of the exception and you have a lot of work as an influencer. I still feel there's a cost, because, you know, usually you're promoting someone else's agenda, or, you know, it's very rare that you have an influencer that's full of integrity, and they're regularly using the products that they're promoting, and they believe in them. And it's also rare that an influencer also is extremely qualified in their field. So for me, I think there are some influencers that have integrity, and they believe in the products, and they are like they're reputable and they're sincere. But I think the money can be an overwhelming motivation. So it ends up just being a career for some of them, where they're just they become a platform for a larger company or corporation, and it stops being a creative endeavor. And so it seems like a trade-off, unless you're really staying true to your work and what you believe in. And I think that's a small percentage of influencers.
Yeah, I think I agree. But, you know, everybody to their own.
I'm not judging people who are finding a new way to support themselves. I think it's great that they're able to do that and not the other thing that might be less desirable and less lucrative. So
yeah, I mean, but you know, in some ways I kind of admire that, because they're making it happen. You know, it's they're making their way in the world, whether it will last forever or whether, you know, we're starting to see people in trouble for not talking about the fact they're being paid to recommend something. And maybe we'll get more of that, as, you know, that people should be honest. It'd be nice if they're really telling you that this great makeup that they're using is really good, and why, not that they've been paid money for. But so be it.
Yeah, I agree. It's good that they have an avenue to make it through the world. For me, I guess my approach so far has been a little more traditional in some ways, because my livelihood at the moment comes from teaching privately. And what I like about that is I'm learning about my craft as I teach, whether it's piano or guitar or music theory. So in a sense, I feel like I'm being compensated just to further my studies, which for me really, really impact what I create. The more knowledge I get, I actually feel it lends itself to a higher level of art, at least to me. You know, some artists, whether it's music or whatever craft, they don't necessarily feel like they need you know, a formal training or whatever. But I've always been so interested in the tradition of different crafts. So for me, I really welcome like a deep understanding of the music that has come before me and how that brings us to today's music. And so I've really been enjoying that side of what I do, and also the flexibility of it, because I have a lot of online students and I have all sorts of different technology and things to make it easier for them to learn online. So that allows me to travel and to just explore other opportunities. And I don't know if that would have been possible 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I think the pandemic may have even accelerated those possibilities, because, you know, we're more accepting remote work and things like that.
Well, I my heart goes out to you. I think it's lovely. I'm sure that you get a real buzz out of helping youngsters learn how to play. I mean, I think that's really very nice thing to do, you know, to encourage the next generation. Photographers tend to work in isolation most of the time. So although I have lots of friends that are photographers, we don't really kind of mix or talk about our photography very much. So it's, I suppose, because it's in some ways competitive, I suppose, I don't know. But, you know, trying to help youngsters, I think, is admirable. Congratulations.
Ah, thank you. Yes, service makes me very happy. I can easily get absorbed in myself when I'm focused on my own creations. Even if creating for yourself is sort of its own act of service, I feel like actually providing service to others really takes me out of myself. And then when I do come back to my own work, it feels like I have a lot more balance and clarity to do so. And as far as what's next, as I continue to educate, you know, I'm exploring other avenues of like where I can, like where my music can exist in the world. And I think there are more possibilities with that too than there were previously, whether it's people using your music for social media or film and TV. There's you know, there are more films and shows and documentaries being made than ever before. So there's no shortage of possibilities there. It's just a matter of finding those opportunities. So that's kind of,
I think when you see what's being produced on Netflix, etc., they're making some wonderful content, and you know, as a photographer, the way that they're shooting stuff and they're experimenting, and you know, the effort that goes into the styling, the location, and the whole thing, you know, it's moved on so far. The photography in these programs is I think still being invented, you know, with the use of music and titles, you know, all as an art form. Powerful stuff.
Absolutely. Well, shall we wrap this up?
Yeah. Thank you very much for your company and for your interest in what I do. A little plug for my book, Monochrome, is out in October. Available to buy in advance on Barnes & Noble or Amazon or all good bookshops. If anybody wants to see some of my work, they can have a look at me on peterdaisley.com. That's DAZELEY. Thank you again for your time and company.
Beautiful. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you so much. I hope that...